From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Richmond, California.
San Jose.
Union City.
Eastside. Jackson.
I'm from the Campbell area.
Hayward.
Coming up, law enforcement recently cleared out a homeless encampment under a freeway near downtown San Francisco.
I got on my bike and I stopped what I was doing. I came all the way back over here and all my stuff was gone.
We'll have the story of why that hasn't stopped homeless people from coming right back. Also, a conversation with the head of homeless policy in San Francisco about the radical ideas he's hoping to make happen.
WOOF is Wonderful Opportunities for Occupants and Fidos.
Commissioning impoverished people to care for homeless pets. And we'll contemplate some other big ideas, such as how to acquire wisdom.
And wisdom was, I think, something related precisely to the shamanic moment.
Are you ready for 30 minutes of wisdom? Cross Currents is next. We're in the Bay Area's rainy season, and the city's 6,455 homeless people are looking for places to stay dry. In San Francisco, the spaces under freeways are popular, and groups of homeless people sometimes band together for their mutual protection. Down the road from AT&T Park, squeezed between the Caltrain and the Muni tracks, a small group of people make their home beneath an I-280 on-ramp. They pick up trash and sweep out their living spaces. Some have lived there for years. They are a community. They are also trespassing on state-owned land. Caltrans has sent in law enforcement to clear people out more than once this year. And still, the residents return. KALW's Mary Reese has the story.
As the San Francisco Giants were winding down regular season play in their home stadium, the California Highway Patrol and city police were ramping up efforts to remove another group of San Franciscans who call King Street home. People have been sheltering under the I-280 on-ramp at 5th Street and King for about 10 years. That is, until the authorities arrived in late August.
I was over painting my ex's RV, and one of the residents here came over and told me, hey, they're taking your stuff.
Anthony Ford had been living under the ramp for about 13 months. He recounts what happened to him the day of the raid.
I got on my bike and I stopped what I was doing. I came all the way back over here, and all my stuff was gone. Me and two other people, you know, they just took all that stuff right there and threw it right into the truck.
For freelance writer Ian Smith, who'd been living in the encampment since February, it felt like a home invasion.
Sandra and Tomas, the couple over there, sat there and basically made a home, you know, back there. And, yeah, there's flowers and, you know, a little, you know, rock garden.
What happened to the flowers?
Oh, you know, they came through, I guess, stormtroopered them, you know, like ripped them up and, you know, leveled out the ground. And, you know, I guess no reason for beauty there underneath the bridge. So they tore it up.
The encampment was like an apartment complex built of tents, with neighbors watching out for neighbors.
Some people, we've actually had people out down here have jobs, like full-time, 9-to-5s.
That's Jessica Prater, who lived here almost 2 years by the time of the raid. She collects recycling and does odd jobs to scrape together enough change for food. She's planning to return to school to study animal science. Since the August raid, she, Smith, Ford, and several others have moved back under the freeway.
I can trust pretty much everyone down here, and if for some reason something does come up missing, somebody has my back. Like, I was a single female out here at one point, you know, and I never had worries. Like, I never carried a knife, I never carried pepper spray or any, you know, personal, you know, weapon.
Still, it's not ideal. There's constant train and traffic noise. While it's sheltered, it's still exposed. And, of course, living there is illegal. On August 28th, when the CHP removed the camp, staff from the mayor's homeless outreach team, or HOT team, were on hand to offer services. However, the head of that team, Bevan Dufty, was out of town studying innovative solutions for chronic drinkers.
Ironically, on the day that Caltrans went out there, I was in Seattle to visit Wet Housing, and I was there with an eclectic group that included Jennifer Friedenbach, the executive director of Coalition on Homeless.
Dufty has been on the job less than a year, and he says he relies heavily on the experience of Friedenbach, who's worked at the Coalition on Homelessness for 17 years. She lets him know what homeless clients and their advocates want. They work together, but they don't always see eye to eye.
From our perspective, if things are going safe, if they're kept clean, if there's some work done with an encampment, work with the city to try to make sure that everyone has housing, and until that time, allow people to stay in the space that they're at.
Dufty takes a different view.
I am less believing that this was a healthy community and a good place for people to live, but I didn't stand there and say, oh, we've got existing services that are going to meet the needs of these individuals. I went and said to the mayor and to the director of public health, we've got to step it up and we've got to provide a tool that's effective when you've got a hardcore living in the street, living under the freeway population.
During one visit from the HOT team, camp resident Jessica Prater found out that she qualifies for some work programs and help from Child Protective Services.
I was pregnant out here, and so I gave my child up to CPS. I guess they have resources where I can try and get my parental rights back, and they would help me get off the streets, like, in order to do that.
She has also made use of the city's Project Homeless Connect, which recently expanded to daily operations near City Hall. The program matches up homeless clients with volunteers who can provide services like free haircuts or dental exams.
There's definitely good, like, you know, one-stop shop. It's something that we can manage. Like, I can't do appointments every day. And if I'm going to this building, I can't even keep track of the time.
Nor can she find stable shelter, aside from what she's found at the underpass at 5th and King Streets. The day of the August raid, the HOT team managed to place 9 of the 30 or so people it evicted from the encampment in temporary rooms. Bevan Dufty says every one of the campers was offered a bed somewhere, but at the same time, the city's shelters are practically full every day. There are simply not enough low-cost housing options in the city. That's how 40,000 households wound up on the waiting list for affordable housing in San Francisco.
What the city often has to offer is temporary housing that is already housing that other people are in line for. And so really what we need to do is expand our stock. And it has to be affordable and safe and permanent.
Last month, San Francisco voters approved the Housing Trust Fund measure, which uses general fund money to create new and rehabilitate old affordable housing. Advocates are hopeful that living in San Francisco will become more realistic for lower-income households. It's going to take time. Meanwhile, homeless people find shelter where they can, including the underpass at 5th and King. In San Francisco, I'm Mary Reese for Cross Currents.
We contacted Caltrans to talk about the encampment on their property at 5th and King. In an email, a public information officer said they have to defend state property and public safety on their land. The agency is currently taking bids for construction of a tall fence to keep people out from under the freeway, and it plans to install the fencing by the beginning of next year. Now we'd like to hear from you. Do you have solutions to San Francisco's homeless issue? Let us know on our feedback line. It's 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. You might hear yourself on the air. This is Cross Currents. I'm Ben Trefney. In that last story, we heard from Bevan Dufty. He is the Director of Housing, Opportunity, Partnership, and Engagement for the City of San Francisco. Before that, he was a longtime city supervisor, and he ran for mayor last year. In his new role brainstorming solutions to the city's stubborn homelessness problem, Dufty has come up with some pretty novel thoughts. We wanted to hear about some of the most innovative, so we invited him in for a segment we call Radical Ideas.
And now for something completely different.
First of all, think outside the box.
I got the idea when I noticed the refrigerator was cold.
Good idea.
The guy who invented Pringles packaging thought outside the box and made a fortune.
That's a pretty good idea.
He had this crazy idea about breeding pine trees.
Isn't that beautiful? That can happen to anyone.
Today's radical ideas are about ways to engage homeless people with the community at large. We're going to hear about two of them. One is adopting homeless pets. The other is about soul food trucks.
What would a hipster in San Francisco be without a food truck, right? So when I was a supervisor a couple years ago, I learned that our street food culture was really suffering in San Francisco because we were requiring that people had to pay $10,000 to get even just an initial permit. And you were paying the police department, which really didn't make sense to me because they couldn't give you a route. And so everybody was saying that it was just like a catch-22 system. So I went in and we cut the fees to less than $4,000. And I think you've seen in the past 2 to 3 years a real, you know, booming street food culture in San Francisco.
Yeah, you have off the grid, you have huge congregations.
Oh, yeah, off the grid, La Cocina. You've got a lot of great things. Now, 56% of individuals who have HIV in San Francisco that are homeless and marginally housed, 56% are food insecure. What does that mean? That means that they don't have adequate nutrition to take their meds. And here we are in San Francisco, and we've got the AIDS model of care that the world looks at, but people are food insecure, and so they can't adhere to these meds because these meds are tough to take if you're not eating and thriving. And so this motivated me to look at sort of bringing together the notion of street food with the Tenderloin, and to also look at the fact that looking at the disproportionately African-American population among homeless and individuals living in supportive housing, why not do soul food trucks? It's something that I haven't seen a lot of. And so we're looking to create a social enterprise, and I've got different pieces, and I'm hoping to get it launched where we would take individuals who've come through the chefs program. Episcopal Community Services has chefs, Conquering Homelessness Through Employment and Food Services, where they take people out of homelessness and they get them trained in the restaurant business. And I've been in Seattle to a restaurant called Fair Start, which has been operating for 20 years, and they've taken 6,000 people into job training and housing and all these different things. And it's a jumping restaurant, and they actually have a basement commercial kitchen where they cook for the Head Start centers and the homeless shelters and things of that sort. So I'm not that ambitious, but I really would like to bring that vibrancy of street food, maybe at a very low cost. $3 a meal, something along those lines.
Could be a sliding scale, maybe.
Yeah, I'm going to get some advice. I mean, I have a lot of friends in both in the street food and in the restaurant industry, but I want to go bring that vibrancy. I look, people go through the TL sometimes, and it's like street theater. I mean, it's pretty wild out there. And so if I could kind of relate to it, but bring food, bring some tables and chairs and, do something that sort of is something that that people like in other neighborhoods. I mean, that's what I think it's about.
So who would be the clientele? Would you be aiming for hipsters, or would you be aiming for homeless?
Oh, no. I think you would start out, we're aiming for people who live in the community. No, I'm talking about people that, we have 5,000 units of supportive housing, and very few of them have kitchen facilities. There's not a Whole Foods in the Tenderloin. I mean, you got basically fast food and liquor stores, and you've got great organizations such as Glide and St. Anthony's and others that feed people. But, I just went last weekend when I was serving at St. Anthony's. I saw people with tickets, and, St. Anthony's, somebody's going to eat three lunches, they eat three lunches. And you see somebody, I was there on a Friday, and people were getting the bags together and putting the food in bags to, have enough. I mean, it's a challenge. Under state law, you can't be on SSI, which is only $8.50 a month, and get food stamps. And I'm kind of pushing against that and saying, what's that about? It's interesting. I guess that's why I'm excited about it, because it seems to me, as much as people are frustrated with the day-to-day of things, I feel like I have this bird's-eye view on things that I want to change. And some of it is boutique-y, so you can say two food trucks, eight people fostering four dogs. Yes, that's small, but it's inviting people to look at homelessness and leaving poverty and being more independent in a different manner.
Let's talk about that fostering of dogs. Tell me about the dogs initiative.
So WOOF is Wonderful Opportunities for Occupants and Fidos. We decided that for the pilot, we would consider people who had lived in CHP housing, who had been through the CHP job readiness program, and that they had a gold star from their building manager. So there were 40 people that had all of those qualifications. And of those 40, we invited them to come to an orientation. For a population that you think doesn't show up to things, 19 of the 40 came to orientation. That was just huge. And then we selected eight of those individuals. And it was, we learned a lot about it. One of the participants, came back, and, he had some issues with drugs. And, it impacted him. He lost a number of teeth and stuff. And he talked about how he often felt like he had a scarlet letter on him. And he did such a great job. And he came back. And so now he wants to engage and, get his teeth fixed so that he can just go out and be part of the community and part in the mix. And one of my inspirations for this was a guy named Matt Trawick, who had emailed me. And I had learned that, he had been homeless for a couple of years. He's a gay man like myself. And I read this letter, and it said, when I got into this housing — he doesn't live in CHP housing, he lives in another provider — but he moved in this SRO room. And he said, from the standpoint of the city, that was success, right? Like, he's housed. He'd been homeless for a year and a half, and he's housed. And all of a sudden, he looked at that success, and he felt very isolated, and he was quite depressed, actually. And so he was able to adopt a dog, and it changed his life. And the dog is called TLC, I think Tenderloin Charlie. And so he wrote this amazing letter talking about when he walked down the street, people looked at him. People said hello. People knew his dog's name was Charlie. You've got to recognize the humanity of these people, no matter what, no matter what level of distress. I'm not saying you have to accept their behavior when it's bad. I'm not saying that you have to accept them living on the street. But you've got to connect to that humanity, and because otherwise we can't address it. And I'm in this gig because I think we can do better.
That's Bevin Dufty. He's Director of Housing, Opportunity, Partnership, and Engagement for the City of San Francisco. Share your thoughts on his thoughts on our Facebook page. We're KALW News. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Ben Treffney. Many of us like to challenge ourselves, question our assumptions, stay informed. That's why there are programs like Cross Currents. Thank you. But there's a difference between information and knowledge, and yet another variant between those two and wisdom. These are some of the big topics considered in a current exhibit at the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art. It's called A Variation on the Powers of Ten, because it's inspired by a short film of that name produced in the late 1960s by designers Charles and Ray Eames.
Our journey has taken us through 40 powers of ten. If now the field is one unit, then when we saw many clusters of galaxies together, it was 10 to the 40th, or 1 and 40 zeros.
The film explores the relative scale of the universe using factors of 10. Not sure what that means? Well, KALW's Stephen Short spoke with a couple of people involved in this project in an attempt to increase his own knowledge and wisdom. And now he has some to share with us.
My name is Michael Swain. I am part of Future Farmers.
Swain is one of several members of Future Farmers, spelled as one word. That's one sign that this collective probably has nothing to do with the high school organization called Future Farmers of America.
We still get calls from people that make that mistake. I've been at the office where it'll be like, we've got some free dirt, and you know, my brother was really into Future Farmers and would love to give you the dirt, and then not realizing that, you know, we have a small office and we don't necessarily have a place for free dirt.
To be clear, these Future Farmers have nothing to do with sows, cows, and plows. This is actually an artist collective founded by Amy Franceschini. We won't be hearing from her, though.
Sadly, Amy Franceschini is in Norway or Sweden right now.
Franceschini was raised on a farm and thinks she might return to one someday, making her a Future Farmer. So when she needed a name for her design company, Future Farmers seemed appropriate. And when an artist collective sprouted out of that business, the name covered that too. Swain and Franceschini are the artists behind the latest exhibit by the Future Farmers, now on display at SF MoMA. It was inspired by the film The Powers of Ten.
This is a beautiful movie that Amy and I saw when we were in high school, The Powers of Ten, that is very poetic, and trying to repeat that in your from your own perspective and from a new time has so much potential, I think.
The film, from 1968, starts with a narrator describing a picnic.
The picnic near the lakeside in Chicago is the start of a lazy afternoon, early 1 October. We begin with a scene 1 meter wide, which we view from just 1 meter away. Now, every 10 seconds, we will look from 10 times farther away, and our field of view will be 10 times wider.
The scene then expands out to the stars.
The Earth diminishes into the distance, but those background stars are so much farther away that they do not yet appear to move.
then zooms quickly back in from the universe to the world, to the United States, to the picnic, all the way into the skin of one of the picnickers, going to the subatomic level.
The nucleus within holds the heredity of the man in the coiled coils of DNA.
This concept, imagining things in variations of the powers of 10, inspired Swain and Franceschini to contact 10 academics, researchers, and scientists, each representative of a moment in the movie, to discuss their take, their variation, on what we know about the world or the universe from their specific discipline. And, just as in the film, the discussions took place during a picnic. Each started with the same question.
What would be the best way to represent their variation on the powers of 10?
All the elements that were represented in the original picnic in the film, the blanket, the location, magazines, food, were selected by the guests for each of the 10 scenes.
We had a picnic where we talked a lot about dark matter, so the scientist asked for all dark food.
Participants and props were then arranged in the same poses as the picnickers in the film and were photographed. These images are now a main element of the exhibit. And so are the recordings of the discussions that took place.
And what better setting than a picnic, too, because a picnic is a very informal gathering, but yet it requires a lot of pre-preparation for it to go right.
Yeah, and but at the same time, to me, the picnic in some ways is the moment of sharing as well.
Ignacio Valero was one of those 10 guests.
Yeah, I am an associate professor at the California College of the Arts in San Francisco, and I teach there in the areas of humanities and sciences and media theory, ecology, and gender studies also.
Valero's interview in the exhibit represents the first level of 10 in the scale of the universe, the human level, or what he calls the realm of life. His picnic discussion excerpt mentions the shamanic moment, that time when we start realizing we're connected to forces larger than ourselves. On the day of his picnic, Valero experienced a shamanic moment of his own.
It was raining cats and dogs that day, so we were confined to going to the botanical garden, which turns out to be better for me in the sense that the garden represented kind of like a mosaic of different flora of all kinds of parts of the world. And so in many ways, we were kind of like in a little capsule, biological capsule, that allow us to see so many places of the world.
And as in the film, knowledge goes beyond parts of the world, deep into the unseen and the unknown. Michael Swain recalls one moment during Valero's picnic that really punctuates that.
Ignacio Valero was wonderful enough to bring a blanket that was his mother's to the picnic that had these beautiful rainbows on the blanket, and we had a rainbow that day.
That I think
your mom somehow.
Yeah, she was there. You know, my mom has passed on, so that had a very special meaning for me. It was almost like being on the a magic carpet, you know.
Well, that brings it back to you talking about the shamanic moment. That would sound like the kind of thing that a shaman would want to conjure up, to have such a thing actually happen. Did you think that at the time?
Well, it's interesting, you know, that you ask that, because when you're asking me now, in fact, it brings back the whole idea of the ancestor. And I feel that one problem that we have today in our modern society is that we're cut off from context. We're cut off from history. We're cut off from the past. We have information. We have information overload. We have sound bites. Well, guess what? Life goes in a much more gentler way. You know, you cannot speed up the spring or the winter of the summertime.
I'm sure Professor Valeo has pondered such things before, probably in a formal classroom setting. But our informal chat caused him to consider another small wrinkle of knowledge, which Swain might say was a goal of the exhibit.
When you take that conversation and drop it down onto a picnic and ask someone to explain things in a common way, I think you get that knowledge, you get that information outside of the ivory tower and put in ways that I think all humans can understand.
Well, maybe not every human can understand what some of these discussions are about. These folks get pretty intense at times. But the simple act of sitting on a blanket and letting go of time and place gives us the chance to actually notice the immensity and beauty of what surrounds us. Pondering the Universe at SF MoMA, I'm Stephen Short for Cross Currents.
That's it for today's Cross Currents from KALW News. The team includes Leela Day, Audrey Dilling, Nina Gensler-Debs, Angela Johnston, Alyssa Kapnick, Artyom Konohovs, Ashley Ann Krigbaum, Erica Mu, Mary Reese, Seth Samuel, Stephen Short, RJ Sloan, and Eva Sansin. Today's show was engineered by Chris Hoff. Casey Miner is our senior editor. Our managing editor is Martina Castro. Holly Kernan is our news director. And thanks to City Carshare, which provides an alternative transportation option to our reporters. City Carshare is online at citycarshare.org. And we'd also like to thank the following businesses for supporting our second annual live Cross Currents at the Oakland Museum of California last Saturday night. Belvedere Vodka, creator of the world's first Cross Currentini. Magnolia Pub and Brewery, located on Haight Street in San Francisco. R&B Cellars, a winery in Alameda. You can taste more at the Alameda Vintners Club. Thank you all for your generous donations of libations for our live audience. You can find more information about all of them at our website, kalw.org. And now, thanks to you. Yes, you. We are listener-supported public radio. Now, here's a sound you don't hear every day, a guitar pull. The term seems to come from the Great Depression, when a group would get together to play songs. Often only one player would have a guitar, so they'd pull it from each other to have a turn. Bill Hansel, whom you're hearing now, has hosted 16 guitar pulls. It's a lot of pulling. There's always a featured performer, but also time for others to play. And they'll probably share an instrument, if you ask nicely. No need to pull. Hansel's 17th guitar pull takes place Friday at the Sleeping Lady in Fairfax, starting about 9 p.m. For Cross Currents, I'm Ben Trefney.